from Welcome to Gleebooks Author Talks. For today's episode, we heard from Anthony Lowenstein as he discussed his latest book, Pills, Powder and Smoke, with Jeff Sparrow. The book was launched by Green Senator Maureen Faruqi, and she spoke to the human toll of the failed war on drugs.
So coming back to Anthony's book now, while I was in the US, I read this quote to almost everyone that I met while I was there, so I want to read it to you as well. It's at the start of the book, and it is about how this war on drugs came about. So the Nixon campaign in 1968 and the Nixon White House after that had two enemies, the anti-war left and black people. Nixon's domestic policy head, John Ehrlichman, said, "You understand what I'm saying. We know we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black. But by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and blacks with heroin, and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did." And you know, when I was reading this out to people, the vast majority of them was surprised and shocked to learn how contrived and devious this drug war is. And those people were not people who were politically unaware. So I think that's one of the real values in this book as well, that people find out about the history of what has happened and how we are where we are. And it doesn't need to be said, I guess, that there is absolutely no correlation between being tough on drugs and a reduction in drug use. Not one study has ever been able to connect the two. And to quote a devastating statistic from Anthony's book, after 45 years of the harshest drug policies in the world, the UK's population of heroin and cocaine users has gone from 1,000 in 1971 to 320,000 in 2015. With more drug deaths in 2018 than any other country in Europe. So Anthony's book is so important because it shows that the war on drugs that the US, Australia, and the UK, and much of Europe has prosecuted since the 1970s, has had catastrophic results on the lives of millions of people. And it is useful also to remember and to remind ourselves that the numbers we often talk about as statistics are real people who have families, real people who have friends, real people who have loved ones, and who have all felt the impact of these terrible policies. These people are often demonized and stigmatized, which only serves to dehumanize them. And perhaps it is easier to lock up and blame someone you don't see as a person. And that is the purpose of dehumanizing these people. So I really, Anthony, did appreciate all the conversations that you had with people on the front line for this book and made them an important part of this book. I must say the book, at various points, does not make for comfortable reading. I mean, Anthony charts decades of extreme violence across South America and parts of Africa and Asia, mass incarceration, and the creation of entire industries that have a vested interest in continuing the war on drugs. And to quote again from the book, "Believing that law enforcement can solve the issue of drug use, abuse, and trafficking fundamentally ignores the last 50 years of history. Yet, somehow, we still persist with policy that is nothing short of a war footing in Australia." Anthony's original research digs beneath, and I think that's really something I found very, very useful, because it digs beneath the media releases from governments that justify the loss of life and massive expenditure as a moral crusade to save the lives of our children. He goes to where the war on drugs is fought and where the consequences of that brutal and counterproductive effort are most destructive, the Philippines, Honduras, and Guinea-Bissau. And the picture he paints is of whole societies corrupted and battered by an alliance between authorities, multinationals, and cartels. The most devastating message I feel from this research is that the war on drugs is prosecuted by governments with an agenda not so much about catching the criminals who operate this massive transnational industry, but about control over markets, land, and whole populations. It is an agenda that is killing poor people and people of color. And often these things are dismissed as conspiracy theories by many, but the evidence in this book, I feel, is undeniable. And I hope people who read it will have their hearts and minds changed. In the US, Anthony shows that the pursuit and criminalization of low-level drug users is so disproportionately impacting Black communities, which will again come as no surprise to anyone with the smallest understanding of policing and lawmaking. Because drug use is not necessarily higher in those areas. Instead, the rates of incarceration reflect the police focus on lower-income communities and communities of color. And we know that there is disturbing evidence of similar discrimination along racial and class lines in Australia. And I give you cannabis as an example. At the turn of this century, in 2000, police were given the discretion to give a caution rather than charge someone caught with cannabis. So a 2011 New South Wales Auditor General's report found very concerning geographic disparities as to whether someone found with a small amount of cannabis was cautioned or whether they were charged. So police in the eastern suburbs, North Shore, and the Hills districts issue a caution more than 70% of the time. So not a charge, but a caution. But this plunges to less than 20% in Quakers Hill, Walgett, and Bathurst, where there is less wealth, of course, and more Aboriginal people living in already over-policed communities. And we see a similar discriminatory targeting in police use of drug dogs, which have a false positive rate as high as 80% on public transport. And I would suggest there is nothing coincidental about regularly seeing the drug dogs at Redfern Station, but being hard-pressed to find them Bondi Junction or on the North Shore. And these interactions, of course, with law and the criminal justice system are discriminatory applications of the law and have incredibly negative and lifelong consequences. So it does seem that some lives do matter a lot less than others in our society. Of course, we know there is a different way. As Anthony points out, in Portugal, a nation that decriminalized all drugs in 2001, drug use has declined amongst the most at-risk group, which is 15 to 20-year-olds. We know most Australians do not support the current system of criminalization, particularly when it comes to the use of cannabis. The same drivers for legalization that were in the US and which have been effective in recent years are very much present here in Australia. You know, principally to end the ineffective and punitive approaches and their damaging health and social consequences. But at the moment, as the book points out, we spend $1.7 billion annually on fighting illegal drugs, with just a mere 2.2% going to harm reduction, only 9% on prevention, and 22% on treatment. To me, this makes no sense whatsoever. But then drug policy in Australia is forged around moralizing and an illogical and impossible pursuit of a drug-free society based on this very old, heavy-handed law and order approach. But there is always hope, and I want to end on hope. And again, reading from Anthony's book, if a nation such as the US can be so obsessed with punishment and still move towards legalizing marijuana, there's hope for a nation such as Australia to move out of its subservience to Washington and follow its lead. So this book will definitely help us follow that lead, help us get us there where we can put failed, unjust, and destructive policies behind us and end this bloody war on drugs once and for all. So Anthony, thank you for having the courage to tell the truth, having the courage to tell it like it is. And I am sure that your son, Rafi, will really enjoy this book when he can read big words. Thank you so much for having me here. It's a real privilege.
So much, Maureen. My name's Jeff Sparrow, and we'll be having a little bit of a chat up here on stage, and then there will be some time for your questions to Anthony. So if something occurs to you, just bottle it up, and then we'll get to you in due course. But Anthony, I've got to start with the obvious question. When did you become so interested in drugs? I mean, it's a serious, serious question. People will know your work, your book on disaster capitalism, your work on the blogging revolution, your associated on an ongoing basis, the questions of Israel and Palestine led you to want to write about drugs.
Before I get to that, I just wanted to say, firstly, to thank everybody for coming, friends, family, colleagues, supporters. It means a hell of a lot. I don't live here these days. I'm living in very unholy land of Jerusalem, so it's wonderfully humbling to see everyone here, so thank you. Why this book? I see myself in many ways as a post 9/11 journalist. I started doing journalism before 9/11, but particularly in 2003, moved to Sydney from Melbourne. A lot of the work I've done in the last 15 years, some connection to US foreign policy or the issues of imperialism. So into Afghanistan a number of times, investigating the occupation there. In Palestine now, I've spent years going there, seeing the reality of what that means on the ground. And I think in the last years, I really thought that one of the major untold stories, certainly in my work and much of, I think, of in my view, accurately in much of the public, is the drug war. The drug war, I think, as I talk about in the book extensively, I argue the most deadly war of the last 50 years. It's killed countless millions. And so it's not just a question for me about going to these places. The book goes to Honduras, Guinea-Bissau in West Africa and Philippines, UK, Australia. Also looking at the political reasons why this happens, and the drug war I wanted to explain is a war on the poor and a war on minorities, as Maureen rightly says, in Australia or elsewhere. And that to me seemed like a story worth telling. And also just finally, sense was speaking to people who weren't as engaged on this issue as me was that they would say, oh yes, I guess there's a drug war happening in Mexico because you see now and then crazy stories on the headlines. But, you know, US states are legalizing marijuana and therefore isn't that drug war kind of winding down? And in fact, the reality is it's never been more brutal and it's never been harsher. There are clearly, Maureen says, the book says, and facts say, a shift in the last 10 years in many countries towards or states in the US to legalizing cannabis. To be sure, we'll get to that if people want later. But putting cannabis aside for a second, the vast majority of the drug war is not about cannabis, it's about other drugs. And the effect of that on countless civilians in many parts of the world, putting aside those who are using those drugs in Western states, devastating, as I show in the book.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, to give people an idea, if they haven't read the book, it's structured around a narrative of visiting various sort of hotspots in the drug war. And one of the first chapter is to do with Honduras, which I guess for many people kind of fits that description that you're talking about of a narco state. You travel through a city called San Pedro Sula, which is rated as one of the most violent places in the world. So give us a sense, what does the war on drugs look like in a country like Honduras?
So Honduras is a very, very challenging place to work. It is a country, most people I'm sure are aware, which is a neighbor of the US. A lot of the refugees who are trying to get into Trump's America are coming from Honduras. And it's very frustrating to me seeing so much of the US media coverage about this country, because so often people say they're coming from Honduras, but really go there to find out why they're leaving Honduras and what is the cause of that violence, too often from Washington policies. What is Honduras like? Honduras has one of the highest murder rates in the world. That's been the case for a number of decades. There is something anyone who wants to own a business there, whether it's a small shop or a food stall or something else, has to pay a so-called war tax. And a war tax could be paid to 1, 2, 3, 4 gangs in your area. If you don't pay a weekly tax, they will actually shoot you dead. It's not a question of they might, they will. People in many cities don't go outside at nighttime. They stay in their house. I went to areas in San Pedro Sula, as you say, and Tegucigalpa, which are the two major cities in the country. People are so fearful. They are fearful of the state. They're fearful of gangs. They're fearful of police. The police are not your friends there. And the effect of the drug war is that the majority of cocaine going into the US is going via or through Honduras from Colombia and Venezuela. So there's not a lot of coca plants being grown in Honduras, although that's changing. So the effect of that is you have a completely enriched cartel industry, which is able to pay off and buy off governments. The leader of the country down, this has been the case for years, is deeply, deeply corrupt. And interestingly enough, during the Obama years, the so-called liberal renaissance that we've all forgotten so much about, there was a coup there in 2009 in Honduras. The Obama administration supported it. The country was a crisis before that, but it's got far worse in the last 10 years. Violence has increased, drug use and drug abuse has increased, and cartel violence has increased. So on the ground, that meant that people were scared. And it makes unbelievable amounts of sense why you'd want to leave that and try to move to somewhere else. And that often is the US, although, of course, Trump's making that very hard.
One of the other countries that you go to, and for me, one of the most interesting chapters in the book is set in the Philippines, where the Duterte regime is waging a particularly violent and a particularly explicit war on drugs, which essentially amounts to a regime of sanctioned state killings. And you describe witnessing the aftermath of one of these summary executions. At the same time, you describe that a lot of the people that you talk to are actually quite supportive of Duterte and his execution squads. So can you tease out that contradiction to us? Because it seems quite surprising. The reality you describe is so horrific, yet quite well-meaning people that you're talking to are actually quite positive about the regime.
Duterte is a really fascinating, grim example, and someone who Trump deeply admires, which maybe speaks volumes about the kind of man Duterte is. And in fact, there was a midterm election in the Philippines this year and Duterte's support went up. So people thought that after roughly 30,000 murders in the last 2.5 years, mostly low-level, poor drug users, the rich are never targeted. Do we think cartels are attacked? Of course they're not. Do we think anyone in serious power is being attacked? Of course they're not. It's a war on the poor. Now, the obvious question is, which I tried to tease out, why is he so popular? And a lot of people you speak to will say before Duterte, there was a great deal of poverty and insecurity in many of the streets of Manila and elsewhere. And Duterte promised he would make the streets safer. In some areas, he has. But it depends where you live. So yes, maybe you can now take your young child out for a walk at nighttime and get an ice cream. But if you're two streets down the road, you also might have your house raided and killed. Now, what was so contradictory about that was that some of the people whose family members had been killed still supported Duterte. It's almost like he was seen as our ideal. Our ideal meaning that wouldn't it be amazing, so the thinking goes, if our society was completely drug-free. So I spent time with the senior drug official in the country who said, we are enacting Duterte's dream policy, which is by the end of his term in 2 or 3 years, although he wants to possibly extend his terms indefinitely, the country will be literally drug-free. Now, you hear that and you go, sorry, what? I mean, A, it's insane that that's even a potential goal. Secondly, what does that actually mean? As in, no one's going to be taking illicit substances? This is for people who want to know. The drug of choice there is a drug called shabu, which is sort of methamphetamine. It's very cheap. And what I found in the Philippines and so many other countries, which is why the criminalization of drugs devastating, is that people are often taking these kinds of drugs because their lives are so tough. Manual labor, sex work, things like that. People who are really suffering and taking that kind of drug actually makes your day go faster and go better. Doesn't mean that one supports the idea of doing that. It means that the reality for people's lives when the economic environment's so grim is that that kind of drug use is normal. It's cheap, it's healthy, so to speak, in that environment. If you criminalize that, I mean, as Jeff says, there's a weird sort of environment there with journalists where people, journalists and photographers are kind of on like a death watch beat. So they're kind of waiting it in a place until they get a call that someone may have been shot dead. So I felt sort of voyeuristic doing that, but that's what people do there. So you go there to a area where journalists are hanging out. My colleague there got a phone call. We had heard that maybe there'd been someone had been killed. We kind of drive out this area, and we found on the ground a man who had been shot about 20 minutes before. Blood was pouring out of his head, had been shot dead in a scrap metal shop. Now, was he involved in drugs? Who the hell knows? What was his name? We didn't really know. Police suddenly arrived. There are locals kind of hanging out. There are kids taking photographs. There are kids sort of standing next to this guy. Suddenly a woman appears who we presumed was his wife or mother or something. She was just devastated, bawling her eyes out, and as you would be. And what emerged over time, and speaking to a colleague months after, because we tried to investigate what happened to this guy and who he was, police say there'll be an investigation, which means possibly nothing will come out of it, there'll be no solution, there'll be no answer. This is the case for literally thousands and thousands and thousands of people. The investigation goes on forever. Indefinitely. It's another statistic. And the government really has claimed that virtually no one's been killed illegally, whereas the actual exact number of deaths is impossible to know, but figures that I trust say probably at least 30,000. That's in 2.5 years, and mostly in Manila. That's an insane number of people. And what you find, although a lot of Asian countries are already very draconian towards drugs, they're increasingly, Indonesia and others, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, are increasingly empowering their police to behave in the same way. Because Duterte is seen as a so-called success, right? He's winning the war, so the argument goes, and he's not being stopped, and his people support him.
Okay, let's go to, because we don't have a great deal of time, let's go to the belly of the beast. You spent some time in America.
Is that Israel or is that America? Well, it's America. Okay, right. Okay.
Well, I think in this case it really is America. And you discuss the Obama administration in particular. And, of course, Obama is famously the president. He's not Bill Clinton, who says that he never inhaled. Yeah. Obama, when he was in Honolulu, belonged to a group called the Chum Gang. This is my description. This is a description I found of what the Chum Gang did. They were a group of boys who loved basketball and good times and marijuana. A favorite hangout was the lush hideaway called Pumping Stations, where they parked their cars, turned up Blue Oyster Cult on their stereos, lit up some sweet sticky Hawaiian buds, and washed it down with green bottle beer. Anyway, Obama is the leader of the Chum Gang, goes on to become president of the United States. Did the fact that he had a well-documented history as quite a heavy drug taker himself, and I think in his autobiography he talks about taking coke as well, what difference did this make for the policies of the Obama administration compared to previous administrations?
I think people now look at the Obama administration because of who's in the White House now with a lot of rose-colored glasses. And on a lot of issues, I would say Obama was a follower, not a leader. That's the case, I'd say, with a handful of exceptions on most policies. Obama wasn't much of a leader. In terms of leading policy change, I don't mean he gave lovely speeches, but congratulations. But apart from that, there wasn't a lot of actual real positive change. Having said that, for his first term, not much happened. The rates of incarceration remained relatively high. He was directing people to often go into places that were selling cannabis and arresting them. The rates, in fact, of police raids were higher than during the Bush years. So he was not a liberal. The second term, things did change. And what two main things I think Obama tried to do. One, he allowed US states to legalize cannabis and not send in the feds to arrest users or dealers. So that was an important difference that I think would not have been the case if George Bush had been president. And secondly, he also allowed US foreign policy towards the drug war is very intimately tied now to the war on terror. But what he did is that there are a number of countries that were looking into experimenting or discussing the idea of changing their drug policy. He was not directing his US officials or the military as much to intervene in those countries. He was more hands-off, which is positive. Third thing I should say is what he also did, which was significant, and I met some people who benefited from this directly. The second term, around 1,700 people were released from prison who are going to be in jail for the rest of their lives and die for nonviolent low-level drug crimes. And he instituted this really quite interesting policy where the message went out to lawyers, the names and details of possible candidates that he essentially would pardon. I met a couple of men who are African-American. They were in their 50s who were going to die in prison otherwise. And of course, loved Obama, as you would, and they'd been there, I think, they were trafficking cocaine. Obama made important changes on this. I mean, 1,700 people when a population in the US is 2.2 million is a drop in the ocean, but nonetheless, rates of federal incarceration dropped a bit during the Obama years. You won't be surprised to know that during the Trump years, it's actually gone up. Though I have to say that, and this is where Trump sometimes, and I mentioned this in the book, is a bit of a contradiction. Late last year was a criminal justice reform pushed hilariously on one level by Jared Kushner, who got bipartisan support, which essentially tried to release a number of people who were in jail for low-level drug crimes. And it has released around 1,500 people so far, which is undeniably positive. It could have gone a lot further. There were problems with the law. I won't go into it, but it was positive. So what I think Obama years showed what is potentially possible, and yet the drug war is so enmeshed in, I'd say, US criminal justice system. It is such a normal way of doing business. And also the pushback against it politically until relatively recently has been low. Let me just finish on this point. It's really significant that this electoral cycle in the US, most of the Democratic candidates, there are some exceptions, but the majority of Democratic candidates are advocating for cannabis legalization, reparations for those who have suffered because of the drug war, and massive investment in communities who have suffered because of the drug war. This wasn't happening in 2016. Now, yes, Trump wins next year. It's business as usual, to be sure, probably. If someone like a Joe Biden wins, less would change than if someone like a Bernie Sanders wins, sure. But there's definitely a groundswell of support for that. And it's pretty glaring that in Australia, with some notable exceptions, that ain't happening at all at the federal Liberal Labor level or the state Labor Liberal level.
I'll get onto Australia in a minute before we finish up. But just while we're on America, Marina, you have both spoken about how the war on drugs is very often a war on people of colour, but you do have a really interesting and counterintuitive little snippet in the book talking about the opioid epidemic in America and the absolute horror of this, the intensity of the addiction that's afflicting working class communities. But you say that in a strange kind of way, African Americans benefited from racism in terms of the opioid epidemic. Can you explain that?
One of the really fascinating, frustrating, enlightening, although clearly horrific facts of the opioid crisis, and I'm sure most people in this room are aware of this, but it is the most deadly drug epidemic in US history. It's killing anywhere between 65 to 75,000 Americans per year. Last year, in fact, the numbers went slightly down. I don't know if that was because of the Trump administration, but it's a huge numbers of people. And I talk about this in the book, as you rightly say, that interestingly enough, for so many years, a lot of doctors in America would not give opioids to their black patients because the internalized racist thinking was they're going to abuse it because, you know, they're black. That's what black people do. They abuse drugs. And the media coverage almost followed that. Whereas in decades past, and I go into this, media coverage of the use of, say, crack cocaine by blacks in America was framed as this is a threat to our society. Whereas when whites were taking opioids and dying and suffering greatly, much of the media coverage, not just from Fox News, from the so-called liberal media, the New York Times as well, was far more sympathetic. There's either an overt or a covert racism that's going on there. There's no doubt in the last few years more and more African Americans are on opioids and suffering because of it. Not everyone using opioid, of course, is addicted. Many are not. But that kind of racism, actually, I'd encourage people to watch. There was a John Oliver segment a few weeks ago about, not about this so much, but about the ingrained racism in the medical profession towards prescribing drugs and how they often see black and white patients differently. It's really, this is in America, of course, although I'm sure it's similar here. It's worth watching. But the crisis that's happening in the US and Obama administration, speaking of failures, mostly utterly failed to address this crisis. And we're seeing now, just ironically again, by the Trump administration, I'm not some secret Trump supporter, by the way, but during the Obama years, that administration did nothing to address the corporations that were making a fortune. And the Trump Justice Department and some other justice departments around the US are now slowly trying to hold to account some of the corporations who actually are the ones making the billions from overprescribing these kinds of pills. And that problem is coming to Australia. It exists here. It's not as prevalent, to be sure, but it's coming. And the broader question, which I talk about in the book, is that even if you legalize all drugs tomorrow, which I advocate should happen as soon as possible and regulate them, it doesn't change in some ways why so many people feel the need to take drugs. And, you know, in other words, what is the whole, and a lot of people take drugs normally. I'm not suggesting everyone who takes drugs is not. I mean, people who are taking it problematically are taking it to fill a void in their life, whatever that may be. And the legalization and regulation of drugs doesn't inherently solve that, which is why I'm finished with this, which is why I've called for the idea that state governments and federal government should have a minister for happiness. It is such a obvious thing to have that it would be a minister and a department who would manage we all sort of know why people often are very depressed in our societies, but find strategies to actually address these issues. In the UK, they have a minister for loneliness now, which is sort of ironic in a way because it was instituted by the Tories who contributed austerity in the first place to make people lonelier in any way. But putting that irony aside, the idea of, can you imagine a major political party here saying, you could see it in a cynical way, you know, we want to make our society happier, we'll have a minister for happiness. I get that. But a minister for happiness would actually investigate why so many people, like in other words, at the moment, who's doing that? Do we think Greg Hunt's department is investigating this? He's a minister for health. I mean, you know, the minister for health ain't doing that. A minister for happiness could. And I don't know, I'm just putting that out there. If any politicians in the room, Maureen, I think it's an interesting idea to imagine that kind of person actually spending their time and our money and resources to investigate why so many of us are actually unhappy and using drugs to mask that.
Well, that leads me to the question that I've been itching to ask you, because very often these debates circle around the question of the legislative regime that we advocate. And you've said before that you're in favour of legalisation and regulation, but leaving aside the legality of it, what do you think the progressive attitude to drugs should be? Should we be encouraging people to take them, saying, look, it's a horrible world out there sometimes, and you know, you take your fun where you can? Should we be telling people, well, actually, this is not going to solve the real problems, you know, and actually it's a distraction from fighting to change society? Or should we simply saying, this isn't necessarily a political question, it's merely a personal question? Where should the left stand on that? Are we for drugs? Are we anti-drugs? Or are we neutral on drugs?
We're not anti, but we're not blindly pro. And to me, let me outline briefly, and I talk about this in the book, but to me, there needs to be, from a very young age, at schools, this is private, public, Catholic, whatever schools you're going to, it should be mandatory that there's drug education from a young age. I've spoken to countless people, and I remember myself, people who are at school now, who say drug education now is kind of a joke. It's either just say no, which clearly is working so well, or it's basically being not really going into detail about what drugs can and often are doing. So that would start early on. The message to me is to make drug use actually on one level normalized. What I mean by that is not to encourage a lot of people to take drugs. It means that to say that 90% of people who are using drugs in our society today, in Australia, in most countries, are using it without any problems. So the idea of saying that everyone who's using cocaine or any other drug is somehow sick or problematic is not something that I believe in. I think a left position actually should be saying that drug use can be normalized. And Portugal's a good example of this. The money that they saved on law enforcement for years goes to education. The message is essentially this: drugs can do harm. Drugs can be bad. Drugs can kill you. There's no doubt that's true. But at the same time, we make it a health issue and a choice issue rather than, in my view, a criminal justice issue, because they're intimately connected. And we say that, in my view, if we're going to be supporting the idea of people having choice that harms no one else, the issue is two things, and I'll finish on this. If there are going to be as much accepted drug use as there is today, most people, like the political and media elites, have one view. The reality is most people using drugs. Australia is one of the highest per capita drug use in the world. I'm really supporting, and I argue this in the book, and I'm saying as many places as I can, there needs to be things like ethically sourced cocaine, ethically sourced drugs. These drugs are real. They exist. They're being used. Let's think about where the drugs are coming from. Who's actually being affected, harmed, killed, in prison, raped, for the fact that countless numbers of Australians and Americans want to have a line of coke every night? Now, is the left position to say, let's not think about that? My view should be the left position, or the moral, humane position, needs to be, let's make drug use normalized while making people aware of the danger. Dangers exist, but the danger often is the fact that it's an illegal drug. People are not dying in New South Wales from bad ecstasy pills because of the ecstasy. They're dying because there's toxicity in the pills. We don't know what's in the pills. If you make those pills pill tested, we know what's in them. And to me, that is a rational, healthy, treating our society with respect, rather than saying to children, as our Premier does here, not my Premier, the Premier, says, don't do drugs, kids. Well, that's working so well, Gladys, isn't it?
All right, we have about 15 minutes for your questions, and we've got a microphone going around. I think there's someone just there.
Anthony, that was an excellent address. It's almost impossible. Just a couple of points you made there. One of them is, are there any countries that have succeeded, and that's an inverted commas type of situation, where things have improved? And if so, what are the lessons that we can learn from there?
I guess you mean success in terms of more liberal drug laws. Is that what you mean? Yes. Well, what countries are doing this? Well, Portugal, as Marine said, is the best example. In 2001, decriminalized all drugs. All drugs. Use has gone down across all ages. The reason Portugal did that, for those who aren't aware, was that the country at the time had the highest HIV rates in Europe, and the country was struggling, and a far from left-wing government said the only sensible, though untested, path at that time was to decriminalise, not legalise, decriminalise all drugs. And there are problems with that model, which I won't bore you with now, but I talk about a bit in the book. I think the fact that it's still an illegal drug means there's still obviously a black market having to sell people those drugs. Portugal's an interesting case. Bolivia is also an interesting case, where they refused a number of years ago the DEA, which is the US government anti-drug arm, access to their country to fight a war on coca. And the export of cocaine to that country has vastly decreased, whereas a country like Colombia, which had a peace deal in 2016, is now falling apart, that peace deal, for a range of different reasons. And Colombia now has the highest rate of cocaine production in the world by a mile. By a mile. So the vast majority of cocaine that's used, consumed everywhere in the world is coming from that one country. And the concern is that's going to be militarized because Trump wants to make that happen. So in terms of successes, there are states in the US where the legalization of cannabis has certainly far from been perfect. And I'm not someone, as I say in the book, who's utopian about this. My view is not to say, to be very clear to people here, that if you legalize all drugs or cannabis, no one's going to abuse drugs or no one's going to get in trouble. That's far from the argument. It's just simply not true. But it treats society with respect, and it says that drugs are a reality. They've always been one. And it's inevitable cannabis will be legalized here. That's almost the gateway drug, so to speak. It'll happen here. And I think what's also going to happen, just briefly, and there's growing first is it's very conceivable that within 5 years you will go to a doctor here, 5 or 10 years, and you will say, rather than potentially showing signs of depression or PTSD or whatever you may have, that rather than being given antidepressants, you get talked through a policy of using ecstasy, LSD, or magic mushrooms in a controlled environment to help your condition. And there is vast evidence now that this sort of treatment can help people. In other words, some people I know who had treatment for literally decades on antidepressants that wasn't helping them, they had one or two sessions on ecstasy and it helped. I'm not idealizing those drugs, far from it. I'm saying that it makes those drugs more normalized in a controlled environment that they can actually help people and deal with our crisis in depression in society.
Thank you very much, Anthony and Jeff. That's been such an interesting discussion. What I would like to actually ask about is how illegal drug use has been used in Australia vis-a-vis the Aboriginal communities.
I go into that a bit in the book, so let me just briefly say that some of the rates of incarceration here for Indigenous Australians per capita is worse than apartheid South Africa, particularly in WA. Not everyone who's in prison is there for drug-related issues, that's true, but many are. And they're often for low-level drug crimes, so to speak. And as Maureen rightly said, and I talk about this in the book, whereas an Indigenous person might be arrested and charged for a so-called crime that a white person is not, is happening just as much here as anywhere else. The rates of incarceration is not on one level like it is in the US, where there's a massive, massive industry around this, although that's getting worse here. Figures came out, I saw 2 weeks ago, showing that the rates of Indigenous incarceration in Australia is actually surging. Surging. And I think in some ways, for a lot of politicians and I guess those in the media, and I go through in the book in great detail, even though I'm a journalist myself, hopefully people think that, I profoundly have profound contempt for so much of the media coverage in many countries about this issue. Most journalists in this country who are reporting on this issue, and there are some notable exceptions, are literally publishing police press releases all the time. This is including on the ABC. This is not just commercial tabloid media, it's the ABC as well. There's some big ice bust, the police bring the journalist down, they film it, and the question is, okay, and what? And what? So you've made a big ice bust, and what? And you speak to any policeman who's honest, off the record usually, and often police who have left the force, and I talk about some of them in the book. I interview Mick Palmer, the former head of federal police during John Howard's time, hardly a radical left winger, who says, we all know the drug war's a failure. Everyone knows it. We're doing it because no one's yet still ready, this is Labor or Liberal, to really tackle this problem and say, it's not working, what can we do differently? And cannabis legalization will likely be the first step towards that, which will A, massively help, I would argue, Indigenous populations, because that's often the so-called crime that they're being put in prison for, on the drug issue.
I have a question around changing the community dialogue and also a personal dialogue. I must say that I started having an emotional reaction as soon as you said ecstasy and other drugs that are illicit drugs can be used in a positive way to impact health. And you know me, I'm pretty open and, you know, very open-minded, but I found myself challenged by that. So what are some strategies, I guess, to change hearts and minds in this area when, as you say, the media conversation is dictating exactly how we should think?
I thank you for that. It's changing, I think, because for decades and decades, the fact that all these drugs, ecstasy, LSD, magic mushrooms, were and are illegal, doing scientific research on them is very difficult because often the scientists couldn't get the drug legally and you can't therefore do the research. The drugs remain illegal, but there are countless studies now. People can find them easily online. There's Michael Pollan, the writer, did a book, in fact, just this year, or maybe it was last year now, talking about, his book did very well. It was a New York Times bestseller, examining this very question. He himself sort of became a guinea pig of sorts, taking some of these drugs. He wasn't a depressed person, but taking these drugs to see what impact it had on his mental health. And what you find in study after study after study, most of the studies so far are of relatively few people, but that is changing. The major group in the US is called MAPS, and they're working, in fact, with the US government to potentially, they're on third level trials of ecstasy for people who potentially have issues with depression, smoking addiction, alcohol addiction, a to much better manage their own mental health about preparing themselves for they're going to die. And these drugs, not for all, but for many, can profoundly change how you view your life. I'm not idealizing these drugs. I'm saying that it's very conceivable that in the coming years, legally accepted by the state, and in my view, there should be for any drug that's legalized, no advertising whatsoever, by the way, zero. How that's going to work practically, let's see, with our capitalist system, but that's how I think it should be, that drugs like ecstasy and LSD and others will be seen as a normal, healthy part of a treatment plan if you potentially need it or want it. Doesn't mean, just to be clear, like with all a legalized or regulated market, that you simply go into a shop and buy ecstasy pills. No one, including myself, argues that at all. Depending on the drug itself, it depends on how it's available. Cannabis would be far more easily available than, say, heroin, to be sure. It is conceivable that you would have to get a prescription for various drugs, or ecstasy could be distributed in a variety of ways, and I talk about that in the book, rather than simply being available over the counter. But there are models for that, and I talk about some of my own ideas and others. But those kinds of drugs have been demonized for so long, and it's remarkable to me that despite that, there is now amazing research that shows that they can actually help a lot of people who are in deep trouble. And the evidence is there for that, and more people, I think, are recognizing that. I mean, it's already happening in Sydney and Australia now. There are a number of doctors who will have ecstasy sessions, privately, of course, for people who have depression or PTSD or addiction issues. I know it's happening here, in all cities in Australia and in the US. And it's going to happen more, and I encourage that to happen more, and I would love to see far more discussion in Australia, to answer your question indirectly, about why this is so necessary, that if we have a crisis, as we do in Australia, about people's mental health, that these kinds of drugs could, not on their own, but on as one part, could contribute to people improving their health and their outlook. And that, to me, surely is a positive thing.
All right. That, I think, would be a good note on which to end. The book is Pills, Powder and Smoke, and it is for sale, and Anthony will be signing it in due course. But I'd like to thank all of you for coming along. I think it's been a great discussion. Thank you very much, Anthony. Congratulations
on
the book.
Thanks, Jeff, everybody.
Make sure you all get a copy of it.